commence this evening with a few references in Isaiah chapter 7. This man Isaiah really dominates the era that we're going to look at tonight. He came along a little after Amos and Hosea, the men we met last week, although I think there's a fair chance that they knew each other, because the number of really great men of God in those days was not large. They certainly delivered God's message to the people in the same general era. We get that as we read the names of the kings in whose era they prophesied. Another one who came just a shade later than Isaiah was Micah. And you find as you read the book of Micah that he says much the same things as Amos and Hosea had said. Again, he was attacking some of the social problems and the injustice of the people, their lack of religious fidelity and things like this. Now, we won't be looking at Micah, mainly because of the similarity in his message to some of the things we looked at last week in Amos and Hosea. But we will be looking at Isaiah, because while Amos and Micah were both countrymen who appealed on behalf of the downtrodden farmers, Isaiah was a city man. He lived in Jerusalem, and he was an advisor to several kings. He moved in high places. He was a statesman. He was one of the men who were very close to the kings of that era. Now, one of the kings is this man Ahaz. And Ahaz was just about the worst king that Judah ever had. Now, last week we saw how in both the northern kingdom Israel and in the southern kingdom Judah, there had been a time of great prosperity. But that has more or less passed now, because the kings who brought that prosperity have been succeeded by others who weren't so clever. And also Assyria, which hadn't at that time exerted its influence in Palestine, has now risen to a position of dominance in that part of the world, and it is starting to trouble Palestine. The three nations that it's starting to trouble are, first of all, Judah, with its capital Jerusalem, and the king of the time was Ahaz. Then Israel to the north, with its capital Samaria, and the king at this time is Pekah, the son of Remaliah. And then immediately to the northeast of Israel you have Syria, with its capital Damascus, and its king is Rezin. Now, these three nations all feared the encroachment of Assyria upon them. What Rezin and Pekah did was to hatch up a plot, you might say, to get the idea that if they could form a three-part alliance of these three nations, Syria, Israel, and Judah, that would give them a fair amount of stability and enable them to withstand Assyria. So Rezin of Syria and Pekah of Israel approached Ahaz of Judah and put the suggestion to him. Ahaz refused to cooperate. Whereupon Syria and Israel decided that they would invade Judah, conquer Jerusalem, kill Ahaz, and put their own puppet king on the throne of Jerusalem. And this way they could then force Judah into the alliance, and so they could get their three-part treaty that they wanted so as to withstand Assyria. So when Syria and Israel, their combined army, came and attacked Jerusalem, Ahaz, the king of Judah in Jerusalem, panicked. He had the thought of going to get outside help, getting some other nation to come and help him withstand this attack. And then he is met by Isaiah. And Isaiah brings the message to him, trust in God. Do not trust in any other nation to come and help you. If you trust in God, God will repel this attack and you will be delivered. But if you don't trust in God, then no matter who you go to get to help you, you will not be saved. That more or less is what the opening verses of chapter 7 of Isaiah tell us. So we'll just read these through. This must be one of the best sections in the Bible to emphasize to us the need for living by faith, which is the way all God's people should live. We walk by faith, not by sight. We were saved by faith, and we live by faith. And we've got to keep that before us at all times. And the temptation is always there for us to trust in status, trust in political stability, to trust in programs, to trust in all sorts of things rather than trust in our God. So chapter 7 verse 1, in the days of Ahaz, the son of Jotham, son of Uzziah, king of Judah, Rezin, the king of Syria, and Pekah, the son of Remaliah, the king of Israel, came up to Jerusalem to wage war against it, but they could not conquer it. When the house of David, of course, is Ahaz, the Davidic king in Jerusalem, when the house of David was told Syria is in league with Ephraim, remember we saw that last week that Ephraim is simply another name for Israel, the northern kingdom. So when the house of David was told that Syria and Israel were in league, his heart and the heart of his people shook as the trees of the forest shake before the wind. He was dead scared, in other words. And the Lord said to Isaiah, "Go forth to meet Ahaz, you and Jehoashab your son, at the end of the conduit of the upper pool on the highway to the fuller's field, and say to him, take heed, be quiet, do not fear, and do not let your heart be faint because of these two smouldering stumps of firebrands." That's a bit of a dig at these two characters. He said they're not great atomic bombs, they're just smouldering stumps of firebrands. Don't be afraid of them at the fierce anger of Rezin of Syria and Pekah. Verse 5, because Syria with Ephraim and the son of Remaliah, that's Pekah, the king of Israel, has devised evil against you, saying, let us go up against Judah and terrify it, and let us conquer it for ourselves, and set up the son of Tabeel as king in the midst of it. Now that's what I said before. Syria and Israel together wanted to conquer Judah, get rid of Ahaz, and put their own king on the throne in Jerusalem. Well, this is what God says in verse 7. It shall not stand, it shall not come to pass. After all, verse 8. The head of Syria is Damascus, and the head of Damascus is Rezin. And he's only a tin pot show around the place, so don't bother about him. And verse 9, the head of Ephraim is Samaria, and the head of Samaria is none other than Pekah, the son of Remaliah. And both of these characters are simply smouldering stumps of firebrand. You don't have to fear them. You trust in God, and you'll be delivered. But, last part of verse 9, if you will not believe, surely you shall not be established. You trust, you'll be delivered. You don't trust, there'll be no salvation. We find that Ahaz was not one to believe easily. Isaiah suspected it all along, that what Ahaz was going to do was to go and get outside help. Well, guess where he went for his outside help? This really is ironical, this one. He went to Assyria. Now, these other two nations were coming to invade Judah, to force it to join an alliance against Assyria. When Ahaz wants to repel these two nations, he goes to get Assyria to come and help him. And of course Assyria is only too pleased to cooperate. But you must remember that Assyria was not an ancient benevolent society. It wasn't going to come and help Ahaz just because it was very kind-hearted. It was going to cost Ahab his independence. They'd have to pay a lot of cash, and of course Assyria would then become a dominant force in Judah. So Judah would become a vassal of this nation whose help it had asked. You see, Ahaz was trusting in might and in strength. He was trusting in what he could measure, rather than in the one who was unseen and the one he couldn't measure. When you come to chapter 8, verse 6, this is referred to. And here, a contrast is made between the small channel of water that flowed across the hill of Zion in Jerusalem and the great mighty river Euphrates in Assyria. Jerusalem always had a water problem. There was no natural water supply, and they had to pipe water up into Jerusalem, and then it went through various channels into pools where it was held in sort of reservoirs here and there. There was one of these channels called Shiloah, which flowed across the hill of Zion into one of the pools around the city. And Isaiah uses this as a symbol of God. He said, you won't trust in God. You won't trust in the gentle channel on Mount Zion. You want to trust in something big and great and mighty. You want to trust in the river Euphrates, Assyria. Well, you'll trust in it, but you'll get more than you bargained for. And so that's what he means in chapter 8, verse 6. Because this people have refused the waters of Shiloah that flow gently, That is, they refused the help from God, as Isaiah had said, take heed, be quiet and do not fear, trust in God and you'll be delivered. They refused that. Because this people refused that, and melting fear before Rezin and Pekah, therefore, verse 7, behold, the Lord is bringing up against them the waters of the river Euphrates, that is, mighty and many, the king of Assyria, and all his glory. And what will happen when he comes? He won't stop at just subjugating Syria and Israel. He will rise up over all its channels, he will go over all its banks, and it will sweep on into Judah, and it will overflow and pass on, reaching even to the neck. And its outspread wings will fill the breadth of your land, O Emmanuel. God had promised to be with Judah. I will be with you, he said. But they didn't want God to be with them. And so they trust in Assyria. And Assyria will come all right, but it will sweep right on, even to the neck. Judah will virtually go under. And as you read the story on, you find that what happened was that Syria and Israel did go under. And Judah almost went under, but not quite, up to the neck. And so the people who could have trusted in God because he promised to be with them chose not to trust him. They trusted in military might and it brought nothing but disaster. Now I think the message for us must be fairly obvious. Let us go now back to 2 Kings chapter 16. Because as you know in these talks, what I'm wanting to do is to tie together the books of Kings and some of the prophets. And when you come to 2 Kings 16, the same sort of thing is spoken of. I'm sure we're all well aware, as we read the book of Kings, that there's a lot of confusion in the book. Because the way the man has written is to talk about the king of the northern kingdom Israel for a while, and he goes through until he's finished that. Then he goes back to talk about the southern kingdom Judah, and he talks about him. And then he goes back to talk about the following king of Israel. And then he goes back to talk about the following king of Judah, and so you've got a lot of overlapping, and sometimes things aren't exactly in chronological order, because you're talking about one king through to the end of his reign, and then in the next chapter you go back to the king in the neighbouring kingdom to start at the beginning of his reign. And so there's a certain amount of confusion in it. If you look at chapter 16, verse 5, you'll find referred to what we've just read in Isaiah. Then Rezin, king of Syria, and Pekah, the son of Remaliah, king of Israel, came up to wage war on Jerusalem, and they besieged Ahaz, but could not conquer him. Verse 7, so Ahaz sent messengers to Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria, saying, I am your servant and your son, come up and rescue me from the hand of the king of Syria and from the hand of the king of Israel, who are attacking me. Ahaz also took the silver and gold that was found in the house of the Lord, and in the treasures of the king's house, and he sent a present to the king of Assyria. And the king of Assyria hearkened to him. The king of Assyria marched up against Damascus, capital of Syria, and took it, carrying its people captive to Kir, and he killed Rezin. Now that just bears out all that we've seen in Isaiah. This man Ahaz placed himself completely under the power of Assyria by saying in verse 7, I am your servant, come and rescue me. He paid cash. And he got deliverance from Syria, because Assyria responded by conquering Syria, but of course Ahaz lost his independence in the process. Not only did Assyria conquer Syria, that actually in verse 9 marks the end of the nation Syria as it existed in Old Testament times. But he didn't stop there. When the king of Assyria came, he then moved on down into Israel, and he conquered all the northern and eastern parts of Israel. Syria and Israel were neighbours, so Assyria came down this way from the northeast through Syria and now down into Israel, conquering all this section of the north and the eastern side of the Jordan River here, coming right down then to the borders of Judah. Now that is referred to in the previous chapter, in chapter 15, verse 29. In chapter 16, the writer is discussing the reign of Ahaz. But in chapter 15, verse 29, he's discussing the reign of Pekah, and this is the sort of confusion I mentioned, because in one chapter he's discussing a king of the south, and another chapter he's discussing a king of the north. But in chapter 15, verse 29, he refers to this same attack. He says, in the days of Pekah, king of Israel, Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria, came and captured a whole lot of towns that he mentions, and all of those towns are in northern and eastern Israel. And the last part of the verse says he carried the people captive to Assyria. So that was the end of that part of Israel. But the area around Samaria and the central and main section of Israel still remained intact. But as you can see, it's starting to crumble. Well, Pekah, as you've gathered from the story, was very anti-Assyrian. But there were plots going on. And once his policies had brought this disastrous invasion from Assyria, he was assassinated. He was assassinated by a man called Hoshea. And Hoshea was pro-Assyrian. Hoshea bought time for Israel by paying a tremendous tribute to Assyria, and so keeping it at arm's length for around about 9 years. But of course it was a fatal policy. All it did was keep Israel tottering along, but eventually Israel was going to crumble. So you find in verse 30 of chapter 15 that Hoshea, the son of Elah, made a conspiracy against Pekah, the son of Remaliah, and struck him down and slew him and reigned in his stead. And so he, Hoshea, now comes to the throne. Now if you go across to chapter 17 verse 1, that picks up the story of the reign of Hoshea. After he tottered along for 9 years, he decided to rebel against Assyria by refusing to pay tribute. He got Egyptian help in doing so, and it did him no good because Assyria simply came down and absolutely squashed Israel, and that was the end of Israel. Chapter 17 verse 1. In the 12th year of Ahaz, king of Judah, Hoshea, the son of Elah, began to reign in Samaria over Israel. He reigned 9 years. He did what was evil in the sight of the Lord, yet not as the kings of Israel who were before him. Against him came up Shalmaneser. Shalmaneser was the man who succeeded Tiglath-Pileser as king of Assyria. And Hoshea became his vassal and paid him tribute. But, in verse 4, after some years he decided to rebel. The king of Assyria found treachery in Hoshea, for he had sent messengers to So, king of Egypt, and offered no tribute to the king of Assyria, as he had done year by year. Therefore the king of Assyria shut him up and bound him in prison. And then the king of Assyria invaded all the land and came to Samaria. For 3 years he besieged it. And then in the 9th year of Hoshea, the king of Assyria captured Samaria. He carried the Israelites away to Assyria, and he placed them in various cities. And that is the end of Samaria. That is the end of the northern kingdom. Now the rest of chapter 17 gives us the reason why God wiped out the northern kingdom Israel. The reason was mainly the people's idolatry and their Baalism. They followed all the gods of the Canaanites, and they did not trust in the Lord Jehovah. And eventually, of course, it brought a just punishment. And so God wiped out the nation. So Syria has disappeared. Now Israel has disappeared. All that's left now is Judah, the southern kingdom, with its capital in Jerusalem. But before we leave the northern kingdom, we see there that he conquered Samaria and he took away all the Israelites and he placed them in various cities of the Assyrian Empire. What he did after that was then to bring people from other cities in the Assyrian Empire and settle them around Samaria. Now this is what the king of Assyria did. This was their policy in those days. It was like a giant game of drafts, shuffling people around all over the board. Wherever they conquered somebody, they take the people from here and put them all over the place, and then bring others from all over the place and put them in all sorts of other cities. It wasn't as if all the people of Israel went into one part. They were scattered into all sorts of towns, and then people from all these other towns put back and settled in and around Samaria. This, of course, prevented any of the subject peoples organizing a revolt against the overlord. You find it referred to in verse 24. The king of Assyria brought people from, it mentions a number of towns there, and he placed them in the cities of Samaria instead of the people of Israel. And they took possession of Samaria and dwelt in its cities. And as you read on to the end of the chapter, you find that they intermingled and intermarried with the remnants of the Israelite people who were left scattered around the countryside, so that the people who developed from this amalgamation were of mixed blood. They were part Israelite and part something else. And their religion also was mixed. It was part Israelite, which in itself was a bad religion because it already had taken into itself parts of the Canaanite religions. So it was part Israelite and also part of the religions of other people. So the people that grew up in and around Samaria became known as Samaritans. They were a people of mixed blood and mixed religion, and later on you find there was great animosity between these Samaritans and the Jews when the Jews returned to their land sometime later, in a story that we'll come to later on. But that's the origin of the Samaritans, and you meet them in the New Testament. And in the New Testament again we are told that the Jews had no dealings with the Samaritans because they looked upon them as a sort of mongrel breed of people. And that's talked about then in the last part of chapter 17 of 2 Kings. So what have we got now? Well, we've got Syria wiped out, we've got Israel wiped out, and we're left now only with Judah. And from here to the end of our studies, we'll only be dealing with the southern kingdom of Judah. Ahaz, in due course, died, and he was succeeded by his son Hezekiah. And you have to admire this man Hezekiah. He came to the throne when Assyrian power was at its peak in Judah, religiously and politically. And Hezekiah set out to rid the country of every trace of Assyrian influence he could find. Let us read in chapter 18. In verse 3, it says that Hezekiah did what was right in the eyes of the Lord according to all that David his father had done. He removed the high places and broke down the pillars and cut down the Asherah. He broke in pieces the bronze serpent that Moses had made, for until those days the people of Israel had burned incense to it. It was called Nehushtan. He got rid of that. Verse 5, he trusted in the Lord, the God of Israel, so that there was none like him among all the kings of Judah after him, nor among those who were before him. He held fast to the Lord. He did not depart from following him, but kept the commandments which the Lord commanded Moses. And the Lord was with him. Wherever he went, he prospered. And then it says he rebelled against the king of Assyria and would not serve him. These religious reforms of Hezekiah are given in great detail in the book of Chronicles. Very briefly, what happened was this. He cleaned the temple and repaired it after the desecration of the reign of Ahaz, when Ahaz had introduced all sorts of foreign gods and foreign idols into the temple. He got rid of all that. He reactivated the priests. He got the Levites functioning again according to the system that David had laid down. He reinstituted the sacrifices which had fallen into disuse during the time of Ahaz. He had a new Passover. First time there had been a Passover for a long time, because the people had fallen away from God. And there was a tremendous response from the people as they brought their sacrifices and offerings, so great in fact that he had to build special storehouses to stack all the goods away. After he reorganized Jerusalem, he moved out into the country areas until the Reformation spread right through Judah. So much for his religious reforms. Politically, he also reformed by refusing to pay tribute to Assyria. He strengthened Jerusalem's water supplies. He got ready, because he knew he was going to bring an attack upon himself. He got ready for a siege, and when he found the time was right, he then rebelled. And here comes the problem. Although he was a good man, he committed exactly the same mistake as Ahaz had before him. Ahaz was a bad man, Hezekiah was a good man, yet they both made the same blunder. Instead of trusting completely on God, they were tempted to trust on some foreign power. Now that is the very mistake that we're all prone to. Let's suppose that somebody is guilty of a certain thing that he's done to me. I can just as easily be guilty of the same sort of thing, even if I am innocent of some of the things that person accuses me of. Take a very simple illustration. Supposing that person is guilty of malicious gossip and slander. None of it's true that he's saying against me. And then, because I know he's saying that against me, I tend to then say the same sorts of things about him to other people. Now, the things I say may even be true, but I'm still guilty of fundamentally the same thing, which is gossip and slander, even if I'm right and he's wrong. You see what I'm getting at? Now, this is Hezekiah's problem. Ahaz was bad and did bad things. Hezekiah was good, and yet he fell into exactly the same trap that the bad man had fallen into. He failed to trust in God. I find this a very, very stern warning for all of us. We can never sit back and rest on our laurels and say, we've arrived. In spite of the commendatory things which are said here by the writer of Kings, when you go to Isaiah, you find that the man is in trouble. Let's go to Isaiah chapter 30. We'll come back to 2 Kings in a moment, but just a few things here in Isaiah 30. Verse 1. Woe to the rebellious children, says the Lord, who carry out a plan, but not mine, who make a league, but not of my spirit, that they may add sin to sin, who set out to go down to Egypt without asking for my counsel, to take refuge in the protection of Pharaoh and to seek shelter in the shadow of Egypt. But, he says, the protection of Pharaoh shall turn to your shame and the shelter of Egypt to your humiliation. Hezekiah is rebelling against Assyria, but instead of trusting in God, he now is trusting in Egypt. Again, it's a failure to opt for the quiet repose of faith. Instead of the quiet trust, there is rather the trust in might and strength. Well, it won't work, says Isaiah. It won't work any more for Hezekiah than it did for Ahaz. And he brings exactly the same message to this man as he brought to his evil predecessor. Look at verse 15, very much the same as we read in chapters 7 and 8. For thus says the Lord God, the Holy One of Israel, in returning and rest you shall be saved, in quietness and in trust shall be your strength. But you would not. You said, no, we will speed upon horses. Let's go to chapter 31, you'll find the same thing again. Devastating stuff, this. Woe to those who go down to Egypt for help and rely on horses, who trust in chariots because they are many, and in horsemen because they are very strong. But do not look to the Holy One of Israel or consult the Lord. The temptation which every person in a prosperous, well-organized, secure country faces. Everything's so well-organized and so safe that you don't feel the need to trust in God. And so it was with these people. Verse 3, the Egyptians are men and not God. Their horses are flesh, not spirit. And when the Lord stretches out his hand, the helper will stumble, and he who is helped will fall, and they will all perish together. Egypt will stumble, and you'll go down with them. Now the story that we're referring to here is the well-known story which we're going to look at in Kings in a moment, where the Assyrians surrounded Jerusalem. Because Hezekiah had refused to pay the tribute, the Assyrians invaded, and Hezekiah was in great straits. And God was again saying, you see, no point in trusting in Egypt. I will deliver you. Egypt won't deliver you. I will get rid of the Assyrians without any help from Egypt, but you've got to trust in me. And so in verse 8 of chapter 31 of Isaiah, God says that the Assyrians shall fall by a sword not of man, and a sword not of man shall devour him. God is going to do something miraculous to get rid of the Assyrians. All right, now we can go back to 2 Kings chapter 19. We'll pick up the story there. While you're finding that, I'll just fill in what's happened in 2 Kings chapter 18. What has happened is that Hezekiah has rebelled, and the Assyrians have come and surrounded Jerusalem. Now you know the story, it's a very colourful story. They said rude things to the people, and they said, nobody can deliver you from us. None of the gods of any of the other nations round about have delivered them, and your God won't deliver you. So you may as well surrender and be done with it. Poor old Hezekiah, in chapter 19, verses 1 and 2, when he heard it, he rent his clothes and covered himself with sackcloth and went into the house of the Lord. Now that's a very sensible thing to do when you're distressed. And verse 2, he sent Eliakim, who was over the household, and Shebna, the secretary, and the senior priests, covered with sackcloth, to the prophet Isaiah. He sent these people to Isaiah. Now he had ignored Isaiah's advice, as we saw in the book of Isaiah, but now he's forced to admit that Isaiah was right. And so he comes back to Isaiah and asks his help. Well, they take their message to Isaiah, and as you read on, you come to verse 6, and Isaiah sends this message back. He says, say to your master, thus says the Lord, do not be afraid because of the words that you have heard, with which the servants of the king of Assyria have reviled me. Behold, I will put a spirit in him so that he shall hear a rumour and return to his own land, and I will cause him to fall by the sword in his own land. You read on a little further and you find that Assyria did lift the siege for a while because they were threatened elsewhere. But they'd no sooner gone than they sent some messengers back with further threats to Jerusalem, to Hezekiah, saying, don't think we're leaving, we're coming back, and when we come back, we'll deal with you properly, worse than we were going to do in the first place. Well, poor old Hezekiah, things were going from bad to worse. And when in verse 14 he received these messages from the king of Assyria, he was greatly distressed. And it says that he went up to the house of the Lord again and spread it before the Lord. That's a beautiful expression, isn't it? That's what prayer really is, spreading it before the Lord. Not trying to twist God's arm, not trying to bludgeon God to do what we want him to do, but simply giving him access to the problem. Faith. Spreading it before the Lord and saying, Lord, it's over to you. We're utterly at our wit's end. And that's true faith now working. And so he spread it before the Lord. He prayed a magnificent prayer from verse 15 onwards. And he's not concerned for himself here, he's concerned for God's glory. O Lord God, he says, who art enthroned above the cherubim, thou art the God, thou alone are all the kingdoms of the earth, thou hast made heaven and earth. Verse 16, incline thy ear, O Lord, and hear. Open thy eyes, O Lord, and see, and hear the words of Sennacherib, which he has sent to mock the living God. Of a truth, O Lord, the kings of Assyria have laid waste the nations and their lands, and they have cast their gods into the fire, for they were no gods, but the work of men's hands, wood and stone, and so they were destroyed. But now, O Lord our God, save us, I beseech thee, from his hand, that all the kingdoms of the earth may know that thou, O Lord, art God alone. The great mistake that Sennacherib, the king of Assyria, made was to class Jehovah with all the tin pot gods of the other nations round about. God was not like those other gods of the nations. Assyria thought that because they had beaten all the other nations and conquered those nations' gods, therefore they could beat Judah and conquer its God. And that's where they made their big blunder. And so the word of Isaiah comes in answer from God again to Hezekiah in verse 20. Thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, your prayer to me about Sennacherib, king of Assyria, I have heard. This is the word that the Lord has spoken concerning him, concerning Sennacherib, king of Assyria. She despises you, she scorns you, the virgin daughter of Zion. She wags her head behind you, the daughter of Jerusalem. Assyria mocks Jerusalem. But verse 22, whom have you mocked and reviled? Against whom have you raised your voice and haughtily lifted your eyes? Against the Holy One of Israel. By your messengers you have mocked the Lord. You have said, with my many chariots I have gone up to the heights of the mountains, and I've done this and I've done that. And you've boasted in your strength, he goes on to say. But the one you've really been mocking is Jehovah. And Jehovah won't tolerate it any longer. And the message goes on to say how that Assyria is going to be smitten with a sword not of man, as Isaiah himself has said in chapter 31, verse 8, that we just read. So you read down later on in the chapter, and you come to verse 35. And that night the angel of the Lord went forth and slew 185,000 in the camp of the Assyrians. And when men arose early in the morning, behold, these were all dead bodies. Then Sennacherib, the king of Assyria, departed. He went home and dwelt at Nineveh. And as he was worshipping the house of Nisroch, his god, he was assassinated. It's an amazing story, isn't it? And just before we leave, let us look at chapter 20, because we have another reference here to the tendency which was always there in Hezekiah to trust in any nation that looked as if it wanted to form an alliance against Assyria. You see, he was so anti-Assyrian that he had a tendency to cooperate with anybody else who was anti-Assyrian. And that wasn't always a good thing. Chapter 20 is the story of how Hezekiah was sick. And we find that people come from Babylon to visit him. Now you can be sure that they didn't come all the way from Babylon to visit Hezekiah because he was sick, simply to bring him a box of chocolates or a bunch of flowers. They came because they knew that Hezekiah was anti-Assyrian. Now Assyria was the dominating power of the era. Babylon was just starting to flex its muscles. It was just putting its foot on the first rung of the ladder in its climb to the top. It would be a long time before Babylon was the world power that we're going to meet later on. But it was looking for allies. And this gave them the excuse to send some envoys to Hezekiah and sound him out. And you find that Hezekiah can't resist. The poor chap here is just so anti-Assyrian, he couldn't resist cooperating with anybody else who had an anti-Assyrian look on his face. And so you find that when he came there, Hezekiah, in verse 13, welcomed the envoys from Babylon and showed them all his treasure. And he showed them all that was in his storehouses and all his armory, it says. And so he's getting across to them the idea that he's well equipped. He's got plenty of armor and he's got plenty of weaponry and he's got some good stores to equip his forces with. And so he is one to be reckoned with. And this no doubt pleases the Babylonians. They rub their hands together and they think, aha, here is a good ally. And then verse 14, Isaiah walks around the corner and he says, oh, hello, Hezekiah. What do these men say? Whence do they come to you? And Hezekiah says, well, you know, they sort of came from a far country, from Babylon. But Isaiah isn't going to be put off very easily. And he says in verse 15, what have they seen in your house? And Hezekiah knows that the game's up. This Isaiah seems to know everything. He says, they've seen all that is in my house. There is nothing in my storehouses that I didn't show him. And Isaiah says to Hezekiah, you foolish man, you're at it again. Listen to the word of the Lord. Behold, the days are coming when all that is in your house and that which your fathers have stored up till this day shall be carried to Babylon. Nothing shall be left, says the Lord. And so it goes on. What he's saying is this, that if you form an alliance with a country, you are simply putting yourself under that country's yoke. That's what Ahaz did in the case of Assyria. It's what you would have done in the case of Egypt if I hadn't have intervened. And now you're up to the same tricks with Babylon. The fight never finishes. The just have got to keep on living by their faith. Well, that brings us to the end of the reign of Hezekiah. Just very briefly, the reign of Manasseh who followed. Manasseh was a bad chap, and we're going to pick up the story next week as we look at what happened after the reign of Manasseh. You see, Hezekiah had had these reforms, but they seem to have been largely external. And that's not his fault. He did the right thing in getting rid of all the idols and reactivating the religion. But he can't crawl inside people's hearts, and nor can you and I. We can create the framework, if you like. But if the people don't make an inner response, then all the reformations don't really work in the long run. Hezekiah had these marvelous reformations, yet the people themselves were not changed within. And as soon as Manasseh came along as the next king and introduced all the evil anti-Jehovah practices, before you know where you are, the whole country is following him in a slippery slide down into an abyss of sin and filth and idolatry from which the nation never recovered. Rather than try and start the reign of Manasseh, we'll leave it at that point and we'll pick it up there next week.